How big is your world? How big is the world around you? It's an interesting question. You may say, well, why are you asking that? Because, you know, we begin to realize that we might begin thinking in terms of purely physical dimensions, you know, which in itself seems more expansive than we can really know. But, you know, we can also begin to consider another way of thinking, which I believe goes beyond. It transcends those mere physical dimensions. What we call our world may exist in relationship to what exists outside of it. And this is precisely what Jesus reveals to us. Jesus lived in relationship to a bigger world, a bigger reality. He confirms that indeed the world we know emanates from an eternal realm. He spoke of this as the kingdom of God. Breaking in on what has been given control of the world. He lived in that connection. Okay? He became the means of our own connection. And he calls us in the reality of that connection. And that connection is called faith. Today we're going to focus on what it really means to live in this dynamic connection called faith. Actually, we're going to be talking for the next few weeks about this. We're going to sharpen our understanding of faith, but also grow in living in the connection that is called faith. And I believe this is going to be a significant season for many of us. I believe that with all my heart. And today is simply our introduction. We're going to consider what faith is, and the difference between seeing life through the eyes or the power of fear or through the power of faith. So let's begin considering, first of all, you know, what is faith? Well, the nature of faith can seem a little hard to grasp. It's kind of like a bit like the air we breathe, you know. We know the air is there. We know it's central to our living. It is very essential. It is there, but yet we don't see it. It remains unseen. So let's begin with a few ways that we can consider what God tells us about faith. So if you're all ready to write, let's get going, shall we? Faith is the connection to the bigger world. Faith is a connection to the bigger world. It is the intersection between the finite and the infinite. It's between the finite and the infinite. Look at Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. I'm going to read this, first of all, out of the New King James Version. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. It said substance of things hoped for. That is, it is substance, something meaningful, something related to that which is not yet manifested fully in our present experience. It's not wishful hope, but it is something of substance. And similarly, it is the evidence of things not seen. See, there are larger things unseen that we have reason to believe in. In fact, Jesus would remind us that the material world is temporary. And the eternal world is not less real, but perhaps more real. It is also important to understand that faith is not about that which is irrational. It is about that which is beyond finite understanding. It is the connection to that bigger reality. It is the space in which we as the finite engage the infinite. And that becomes personal when the living God meets us in that space. Faith is trust in God who rules over a larger reality. Hebrews 11:6 says, and without faith, it is impossible to please him. This is out of the NIV. Without faith, it is impossible to please him because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. The King James says those who diligently seek him. The point here isn't that nothing people do can be considered good at some level. You know, I believe that God is pleased in some way whenever good is done to creation, you know, to others. The point here is about relationship. We've talked a lot about that God desires to take up residence with you. He desires to come and dwell with you. And that you simply can never have relationship if you refuse to acknowledge and trust in the other. So faith is essential to responding to God's saving love. So if faith is about trusting in God who rules over a larger reality, it would only make sense that faith is essential to trusting what God has done. Which means it then makes it possible for us to be reconciled to him. And that is what the Bible teaches us. Romans 1:17. It's out of a revised version. The good news shows how God makes people right with himself. From beginning to end, becoming right with God depends on a person's faith. It is written, those who are right with God will live by faith. King James says, for the just shall live by faith. The term good news is simply another term for the gospel. We've talked about that. And the word gospel is simply an old English word for good news. And the good news is that God's way of becoming right with him is not by our own capacity to get right on our own, but by our response to that which is done, to trust in his provision. The writer is quoting the prophet Habakkuk, who said in Habakkuk 2:4, he says, look at the proud one. His soul is not upright, but the righteous will live by his faith. It's not pride in ourselves, folks. Faith is about trusting in God, not trusting in ourselves. But trust is not something that is defined only in a moment. It is essential in our response to his saving love, and it is a call into a life of such trust, a lifestyle of trust. True faith is not that which says, you know, I trust God to save me. I trusted God to save me, and I trust what he did and everything, but now I'll take it from here. That's not what it is. In fact, it is the very quality which God has been sowing and will come seeking. You see, faith is what God seeks to find at work in us. God is looking for faith in you. He's looking for faith to be exhibited in you and through you. The people asked Jesus about God's judgment when it finally comes. Will there be justice? You know, but he also says something that should cause us to take pause. Look at Luke 18:8. It says this, however, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? So in essence, he is saying, yes, justice will come, but what you should be considering is, will God find those who are living in the larger realm of his purposes and his power, living out their trust in me? That's what he's saying. Will he find that? Will he find faith? And that question alone is enough reason for me to value these weeks ahead as we're going to be talking about faith, of considering how to understand and how to grow more in our faith. See, faith is seeing the bigger reality of God's purposes and power. The Bible says that faith is a way of seeing. Now, would you agree with me that there's always more than one way to look at something? If you're married, there's always more than one way of looking at something. Their way, right? The right way. But what really matters is how God sees it. See, faith is seeing that there is more at work in any given situation. You look at the situation, faith will say, I know there's more. I know there's more. I know that God has a purpose in this situation right here. The Apostle Paul describes this beautifully in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 18. He said this, Ephesians 1:18, I pray also that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened in order that you may know the hope to which he has called you, the riches of his glorious inheritance in the saints. There's something vital in these words here. It speaks of opening up the eyes of our hearts. You know, we used to sing a song, you know, open the eyes of our hearts, Lord. We used to sing songs like that, and we sing songs that speak of such things, but what does it mean? You see, this use of the word heart in the Hebrew culture was not speaking of the physical heart, not simply emotions or feelings. The word in the Hebrew culture speaks of one's whole inner disposition. It means allow my inner disposition, my inner being to see the bigger reality, the hope to which you have called me. That's what it's saying. See, there is an unseen realm in the world that's more real than the seen realm. Do you agree with that? Oh, okay. I thought you might have all fallen asleep. There is an unseen realm in the world that is more real than the seen realm. The Bible has many examples of what I call seeing with spiritual eyes, or seeing with the eyes of the heart, seeing from God's point of view. You know, examples of where someone was facing what seemed to be an insurmountable problem, and the eyes of their heart were opened to the larger reality of what God was doing. You know, think about Hagar. You know, her son Ishmael, they're cast off by Sarah, and they were exiled into what seemed to be their end. And she cries out to the Lord, and she says, Lord, don't let me watch my son die. And all of a sudden, God opened up her eyes and she saw a well of water in the middle of the desert, and she and the boy survived. Another sees what by all appearances would be an onslaught of Jerusalem. And one prays, Lord, open the eyes of my servant. And all of a sudden, their spiritual eyes were open. And all they could see was a realm of angels circling the city of Jerusalem. He wasn't afraid anymore because God opened his spiritual eyes. One of my most favorite stories, after the resurrection, Jesus comes to talk to those two that are on the road to Emmaus. And after a conversation and everything, they were feeling lost. They were feeling dejected and just really defeated. And he reveals what God had been doing all along. And they describe that suddenly their eyes were open, and they made the statement, oh, didn't his words burn in our hearts? The eyes of their understanding was opened. It was enlightened. There's a dynamic example of this in our roots in the Old Testament, in the book of Numbers, chapter 13 and 14. You know how this is talking about how fear and faith shapes what is ahead of us. And here's the background to Numbers 13 and 14. Moses had led the nation of Israel to freedom, you know, and he's got them free from Pharaoh and from the Egyptians, and they've crossed the Red Sea. They've been traveling for about 2 years now, not the 40 years, but they've been traveling just about 2 years, and they're coming to a place called Kadesh. And at Kadesh, God says, you have been here long enough. It's time to break camp and to move forward. You know, I believe that many of us can relate to such a point We don't intend, or we didn't intend, to get so settled where we are, but the temporary has become familiar. It's time to break camp and to move forward. So Moses calls them to get ready to cross the Jordan and to go into the promised land. And this was the land that had been promised them for over 400 years. That they would have their own country and they would have their freedom and they would be free from slavery. And when they get to the edge of the water, before they go in, Moses said, okay, before we go in, I want to send in a spy team. I'm going to pick 12 guys to go in and spy out the land that they're going to go in and do some reconnaissance for us. They're going to check out what's going on and do just a little bit of fact-finding for us. And 12 spies are chosen by Moses, and they are sent to go in and visit the land. They come back, and two of them, as you know the story, two very different responses. They give a mixed report. Two of the spies say, man, it is incredible. Let's go take it. It's all ready for our taking. God has truly given us this promised land. And those two spies, as you know, were named Joshua and Caleb. The other 10 spies came back. They go, yeah, it's a great place, but they have this whole list of problems why they can't go in. They're not seeing through the eyes of faith. They're seeing with the eyes of fear. And what unfolds is this great picture of what happens when we see with the eyes of fear and not seeing with the eyes of faith. So if we talk about the work of fear a little bit, how fear shapes what is ahead of us. You see, fear exaggerates our problems. Fear exaggerates our problem. Look at Numbers 13, 31, and 32. We can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are. And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land that they had explored. They said, the land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them. Now, I think any of us can appreciate that they were scared by what they saw. The Canaanites had developed into a more organized force, but there is a loss of perspective here, okay? Fear will exaggerate the obstacle you face and the limitations that you have. It will exaggerate it. Fear, it is an amazing thing. God has delivered them from Egypt, the most powerful nation in the world, and yet now they're worried about some local tribe. They've just defeated Pharaoh, and yet they're worried about something else. How quickly we forget. When you look at your problems with the eyes of fear, they get bigger. The more you look at your problem, the more exaggerated it gets. Somebody criticizes you, and the more you think about it, pretty soon you think the whole world is criticizing you. It grows by proportion. You know, it goes something like this, you know. Well, they said, we see ourselves like grasshoppers in their own eyes. And that's their own self-image. And we look the same to them. How do they know they look the same to the enemy? You see, they didn't. There's a word for this. It's called projection. You tend to project your fears on everybody else around you. And that's what they're doing here in this passage. They're projecting their fears. They've been slaves for 400 years, and despite the season of being free, they still are internally they still feel powerless. They're enslaved, not by Pharaoh now, but by an idea, by an image, by a self-concept. Now, let's just stop here for a minute. Because perhaps many years ago, people said things about you or to you and behind your back, and you overheard it. Things that were not true, you started believing those things. You know, these people aren't even in your life anymore, and some of them may even be dead, and you're still believing their lies. You're still enslaved by their image of you. You had somebody, whether it's a parent or a friend or a brother or a sister, who said, you're uncoordinated. So you went through life thinking you're uncoordinated. Or you're never going to amount to much, and so you go through life thinking that you're never going to amount to much. You're not good at all at speaking, and so on and so on and so on. Hey, guess what? You want to know something? I got news for you today. Everybody listening? You're not in Egypt anymore. You're not in Egypt anymore. That's a self-imposed prison. Now, here's what's ironic. They said, this place is filled with giants, and we can't take them on. They're too big for us and too powerful. Now, ironically, are you ready for the irony? 38 years later, when the next generation did go in to the promised land, you know what the enemy said? The enemy said this. They said, we have lived in panic for 40 years because we heard about the 10 plagues in Egypt. We heard about what you did, what your God has done against the most powerful leader in the world. And we were scared to death. We were ready to surrender. You needlessly walked around in the wilderness for 40 years because you were scared. We were scared to death of you. That's what they said. Joshua chapter 2, verse 9, in case you wonder. So you see what happens then is that fear, fear spreads discouragement to us and to those around us. What they saw elicited some fear. That in itself is natural, but instead of stopping and looking at the bigger picture, the fear began to swirl within them. Fear wanted all of the attention. You want to know something, folks? Fear always wants all the attention. It always wants all the attention. And they gave it that attention and gave no room for courage at all. See, this is the essence of what discouragement is. It steals courage. Discouragement steals courage. It spread within them, and then among the 10, and then on their return among the whole people. This bad report of the 10 spies is contagious. By nightfall, their report had spread all through the camp, and it was the infectious fear of those tribal leaders. Numbers 14:1 says, that night all the people of the community raised up their voices and wept aloud. Can you imagine several million people weeping aloud? Can you imagine the sound of that? Here's the problem. Fear spreads. And it spreads like wildfire. Negative attitudes are contagious. Have you ever noticed that? You're at work, and one of your coworkers gets negative, and then all of a sudden, someone else gets negative, then someone else gets negative, then all of a sudden, you find yourself getting negative. Negative attitudes are contagious. When they walked up there to the edge, everyone was excited about going into the promised land. It was only when 10 people come back and say, we can't do this, that everyone else changed their mind. We can't do this. They begin to get infected with a negative attitude. You know what? People always trust the majority. They always trust the majority report because there's always more worriers than there are non-worriers. And there's always more naysayers. And there's always more critics and more fearful and fretful and negative people. So the majority report of the spies was negative. And the truth is, the majority report is almost always negative. Anyone who's going to get something done in the world is going to have to go against the majority report, because the majority of people are going to be looking with the eyes of fear and not with the eyes of faith. (Clears throat) Then in Numbers chapter 3, we find that the discouragement, it goes from discouragement to griping, and fear can lead to complaining and blaming and becoming enslaved to familiarity. Numbers 14, 2 through 4 says, all the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron and the whole assembly and said to them, if only we had died in Egypt or in the desert, why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt? And they said to each other, we should choose a new leader and go back to Egypt. You see, this reference to how the people looked back to Egypt has often been noted as one of the most fascinating reflections of how deceiving our perspectives can become. It was the place of bondage. Egypt was the place of bondage. It was a place of oppression. It was a place where they were enslaved like animals. But now, faced with a challenge, they look back and they want the security of being enslaved again over facing the uncertainty of what's ahead. That may sound strange, but the truth is that we find comfort in what is familiar. We find comfort in what is familiar. They were ready to give up. They were ready to give up their freedom and become slaves again just for a moment of security. See, there is a false sense of safety in bondage. We've all heard of long-term prisoners, you know, when they get released only to go back into jail within just a few weeks. It's said that they have become institutionalized and they do not feel safe outside of the restriction of the prison life. So when a person is in bondage, there are no choices to make. There are no risks to take. There are no expectations because fear always leads to familiarity. The destination of fear, return to what is familiar, stay in what is familiar. You see, we become prisoners of the familiar to avoid the change and uncertainty. And notice this, notice how they blame the inability to move on. Notice how they blame this on God. They're blaming God for not letting them go into the promised land. You see, God wasn't holding them back. It was their fear that held them back. And they're going to die in the desert because of their fear. Next week, we're going to conclude this part of it, and we're going to talk about the effects of faith and what effects faith has on us. And I've talked long enough for today.